Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're still in the throes of the constitutional season. I know that a lot of people celebrate, and as a matter of fact, some organizations celebrate the Constitution by Constitution Week. Some people celebrate it by Constitution Day. You know, and we always kick off the constitutional season because it seems like the last couple of years I've been doing this, it takes more than a week. I've not been able to do this in a week. And that's just due to the fact that so few people have read the Constitution that having to go through this line by line and kind of explaining how the Constitution being violated, what needs to be done, and so forth. Well, bottom line, if we don't go through this, then you don't understand the real problems that we're facing as a nation. We can no longer accept this concept that the federal government is the, you know, the supreme being of all things, and it's, you know, we are subject to their discretion of tyranny. That's not the case. Which is why we went through the Virginia and the Kentucky resolutions before we started this, and we'll go revisit those when we're done. Because the whole point is we're pointing out all of these things that are being violated and how they're we're not holding them accountable, and how they're getting us into this, into the point where we're at the precipice of our failure. So welcome back, Paul. I hate to keep you out there lingering and waiting for me to bring you back in, but anyway.
No problem. Thanks for having me back.
You know, problem. I can't express enough how I appreciate, and I've gotten a lot of feedback from a lot of different people that said, you know, hey, having Paul, you know, on going through the ratification debates, it was really helpful, and going through the Constitution, this is helpful, because I would just go through this, like when I went through all of those articles when you were sick and down, and I only went through it in a day, and I went through quite a few. And so anyway,
let me add something if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
No, it's not like we don't have it. The Constitution is less than 5,000 words. A person can sit down and read it in one sitting. However, to understand it really requires a little bit of thought and maybe even some research to understand what they were thinking back then, why they did. That's why we read the ratification debates. This small document is chocked so full of depth that, GR, you need to do this. We need to have this type of discussion and available to the public, because if there was ever time that it needed to be understood, this is it.
Oh, I agree. And I believe that what America really needs is the information, not entertainment.
Yep.
And so as easy it is to get people all pissed off about what Biden's doing and how he's taking our guns and how they're going to be mandating shots and how they're killing us and how they're, you know, waging all of this different warfare. We already know this. The question is, tomorrow and the next day and next year and the following years, it's only going to get worse. What makes you think it's going to stop right now? Because now you know all the details, they're going to stop? They're going to unleash even more stuff that you couldn't even think about.
Right.
I am telling you, 20 years ago, I never would have thought when we put an end, actually not 20 years ago, I guess I got to go 30. 30 years ago, when this concept of Hillary care was being, you know, waved in front of America, you know, everybody thought, oh, well, that's over. That didn't go through. And lo and behold, today, look what the heck's happening to our medical system.
Sure.
So, and that's only that. That's, I mean, anyway, go ahead.
And in fact, what they do is they throw out something that is so blatantly ridiculous, you say, oh, that could never happen. Remember the Green New Deal?
Uh-huh.
You know, about 8 years ago, and they threw that out. Oh, that's so blatantly ridiculous. Okay. Well, the challenge is that now they're attempting to force it on it, and some of the people are eating it up. It's and by the way, some of those people who were championing that, and I mean among the people, are crying foul now. I just watched a video yesterday about how a guy that was promoting an environmentalist said, you know, maybe this Green New Deal isn't that much of a good idea. It's more destructive than we thought.
And it is.
Okay. Government. But they throw that out there, and it sounds ridiculous at the beginning, and now you're trying to turn it into a reality, and it's awful.
Government assuming power is not delegated is always destructive. And, I mean, history proves this. So I guess we have to prove history is correct, right?
Okay.
Anyway, so we left off and we were just going into to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer than term of 2 years. Technically, they were to deploy the militia, federalize the militia. Remember, Mason was the one that said, hey, they're going to, you know, grab the militia and they're going to keep them in perpetual formation of an army. And they're going to, you know, just drag them all around the nation. And he was right.
Uh-huh.
But the fact is that's a direct violation to this right here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what ended up happening is the Louisiana Purchase happened. And all of a sudden, you know, our western lands, where after the War of 1812, where we terminated Britain's involvement in the Indians, I'll say the Indian tribes to the west, because they were constantly, the British were constantly getting the Indians to basically frustrate us, attack, and so forth. And so after that, you know, and the Louisiana Purchase, and we now had, you know, land ownership from the Atlantic Ocean to the Rocky Mountains, for the most part, then, you know, you go, okay, so now this new program step forward of this a very aggressive scale of creating territories and states, and this expanse into these new territories became a public relations drive for the federal government, because they wanted to get people out there. Why did they want to create and transition these territories into states? Any idea?
Well, you know, does that have something to do with Manifest Destiny?
Well, Manifest Destiny hadn't started yet. Manifest Destiny really started really towards the 1820s, 1830s. I'm talking about, why did they all of a sudden take this aggressive position to grow our presence in the, what we call today, the flyover states, or the hinterland? The interior.
Well, one, creating states created representation, right?
Yeah.
The territories weren't necessarily officially represented until they became states, and then they had, you know, senators and representation. And the other thing that occurs to me is, land was just valuable. You had a growing population and you needed places for people to go. And so they wanted to expand the territory and they wanted people to, you know, I think they had a vision of a growing population that would need land. Land has, I would say, inestimable value, because they're not making any more of it. I don't know if I hit the nail on the
finite. The availability of land is finite.
Uh-huh.
You can't create more.
Right.
You can expand given land if it is in the ocean by basically dredging. I mean, look at Singapore. Singapore has grown as this, as its physical size by its dredging efforts. But I don't think I would really want to really live in Singapore during a really bad earthquake.
Are you saying that Singapore is below sea level?
No, 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 no. But it's not built on rock. It's not built on, you know, limestone, or its foundation is sand. And even if you had these big boulders that they put in, that's just like gravel in an earthquake. That just turns into liquid. Does that make sense?
That's weird. I didn't know that.
So this is biblical, right? You build your house on sand, and this is the results. Build your house on the rock, and, you know, it can't be shaken.
Right.
Well, technically, it can be shaken, but it won't, you know, your land won't disappear out from underneath you. But anyway, my point is that there are, you know, there's strategic reasons why you want to grow, like Singapore, because their population is growing and they need more land. And so, as a matter of fact, Japan did that in a passive way by putting groins out along their oceans, or I should say
putting
the beaches.
What did you say?
Groins.
It sounded like you said groins.
Yes.
What does that mean?
This is very similar to the human anatomy. There are these perpendicular apparatuses. It's like a pier, but it's, you know, either rock or concrete or what have you, that actually goes out perpendicular to the shoreline. And what happens, because the ocean current, you know, goes along and kind of claims parts of the beaches. And so what happens, because it's erosion, and that, you know, once that sand is taken away, it's gone. So they put these groins out there to keep from, you know, ocean erosion of making Japan smaller.
Okay.
I'm surprised this isn't common knowledge. I'm just kidding. So anyway, so they've got these groins out there to kind of protect their beach line and actually help grow it back. Because as the sands and so forth from the surface of the ocean, you know, come along to the coast or right along the beach, it accumulates, and actually their beaches are growing because of these.
Okay.
Right. Anyway. Interesting. Anyway. So the army itself was intended to defend, but what ended up happening, because I kind of opened this door and hadn't really addressed this, so every territory had to have a security force. So they created the cavalry, and they actually stepped outside of the Constitution by creating this cavalry, because it was no longer using the militia. It became a mercenary force.
Okay. So I always have this particular question, and that is, what would have been the right way to do this? We created the cavalry, but we were growing fast, and the nation wanted to protect its citizens.
Right.
Okay.
And it was a strategic interest. What they should have been doing was they should have actually been developing a better militia system so that they could actually call forth, you know, on a 2-year rotation, you know, basically troops that would be ready. And in doing that, they could allow anybody that wanted to stay in the militia, but you still had to do your 2-year duty to go into the hinterland or into these new territories to keep the peace and to, you know, make sure that the civilians coming out there were protected.
Okay, so this might have required a foresight at the time the Constitution was done that, you know, as we're growing, we need to actively build the militia. It required a foresight that wasn't seen.
Yes, it was.
Wasn't anticipated.
Yeah, we'll get to it. It's a couple of lines down.
Oh, okay.
It's a couple of lines down.
Okay.
Okay, so anyway, that's what should have happened. But it was, it's easier, instead of putting a burden on the state. It was just easier, and the states let them do it. And that was the big mistake. The states should never have let them do it. Are you kidding me? We need to use the militia system, period. And we became more and more apt to allowing mercenary forces exist among us. And as I've been saying, you create a mercenary force, you have instantly created the argument of basically saying you don't need to be armed anymore. In other words, you've created justification for somebody to go, why do you need weapons?
Well, correct. Why do you need weapons? And that puts, in what I've observed, it puts a level of the people having the weapons, this military or this mercenary force, they see themselves above the people. You know, GR, I think it just happens. I don't know why it happens, but when you've got an armed force that's protective, I almost think they always see themselves in charge.
Well, so it always starts with this noble intent, but what ends up happening is, you know, this concept of, well, you know, we're putting our lives on danger here, so we should be getting better pay. We should have better benefits. And over time, this becomes a parasitical body that actually wants, you know, it wants to actually start consuming the goose that's laying the golden egg. And we, in a self-government, every citizen has a responsibility to contribute, not by taxes, but by, you know, work in, you know, endeavors, effort. We all have to put effort in. I mean, today people even shrug jury duty.
Right.
Now, you know, I have a bad opinion of jury duty just because of the corruption of the court system. Mm-hmm. And the court system is completely oblivious to this. I mean, you talk to any lawyer, you talk to any judge, and they're complete. I mean, there are a few that kind of get it, but not enough. There's just not enough swimming in that cesspool that understand that they're living in a cesspool. But anyway, as you know, as we go along, the whole point was that they should have actually used the militia. They should have had a rotation base, and they should have actually allowed those, because there were people that wanted to maintain a career in the militia, or I should say in this federalized force of the cavalry or what have you, like Custer. You know, Custer didn't know he had this compelling need to be killed, but, you know, he met his objective. So when we look at what they should have done, they should have allowed those few younger troops, officers, and what have you, to, you know, a percentage of them. In other words, only a percentage could stay, and the other ones would, everybody else would have to go back. But when you create those types of things, you create favoritism because, oh, well, I like this guy better, or what have you. And as a matter of fact, I think it really should be a lottery. Everybody puts their thing in, and it, you know, there's no play of the commander saying, we got to keep this guy over that guy.
Right.
And
in other words, when it's time to come, you go. And when it's time to go back, you go back.
Right. And if you're an underperformer, then you're basically marked that you can't stay. So, I mean, the only people that would be in that box or in the, you know, this lottery of officers and enlisted that at that point, you know, would come up and say, okay, you're going to do another 2-year rotation. For a very small, and the reason you want that is for continuity. You don't want to bring in a whole bunch of, you know, people that are new, and you want to have that continuity on both sides, you know, of both ranks. And that way, you know, you can maintain that continuity, and at least you have, you know, enough domain knowledge of 2 years of what's going on. You don't have to have the full history. It's nice to have a few people out there with, you know, that are earmarked as, you know, commanders or what have you. But eventually, when the cavalry is no longer in need, it's not this human, you know, this huge force of people that have been serving for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's only, you know, this basically this rotation of people who have done their 2 years of service for the nation in, you know, protecting the strategic interests as we developed it. And so the reason why we were bringing these states in was to actually bring and create more revenue, because every time a new state came along, yeah, they got apportionment and representation, but they started offering more goods and products,
sure,
and so forth that created money and grew the economy and created more and more jobs.
You know, let me touch on something that your point just brings up also, and that is a career military force takes people out of production. So what I think the benefit of having a militia is that, especially a militia for a limited time, is so that people can go back home and grow things and build things. And so, like you said about the
be productive.
Right. I think probably the one of the most important things that's been missed, okay, is that, you know, people in government really don't produce anything. People in the service really don't produce anything.
And to be honest with you,
send some of these people home so they can build businesses and grow things and build things that benefit their neighbors, right?
Right. So let's be clear.
Okay.
When you look at a person that chooses to make a career path in government, where, you know, like military or what have you, and I did 20 years.
Okay.
It makes it easy because you don't have to compete for the job. All you have to do is maintain your standards and get promoted and do those requirements. But it makes it easy.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, a person that I don't want to say is lazy, but a person that doesn't, and I hate to say this, but you know, the people that usually stay in service, a lot of them are people that are afraid to compete. They're just afraid to get out there and be in the workforce. And when you see, I've seen lots of career military folk, when they get out, I mean, in the briefings, in the retirement briefing, they say the average retiree is going to live maybe 5 years.
What?
They live maybe 5 years because they have a skill that doesn't translate into the civilian. I mean, how many companies are hiring artillerymen? You know, I mean, there's a lot of competition in the private sector, but usually companies don't need artillery to call in on their competition.
No, I'll tell you who hires military is police forces.
Yes, and well, we also see like Home Depot and places like that have kind of stepped it up. And under, I think it was Bush, maybe it was Clinton, that was from the trenches to, you know, this classrooms, trenches. I think that was a program they had in trying to get, you know, the guys that were being kicked out of the military a fast track into the classrooms.
Something else.
And I think that was a really good program because you don't, I mean, how many people coming out of the military in those days would be what you would call a far leftist socialist raving lunatic like we have today, all the Karens in school today. So, you know, I think maybe our education system benefited from that.
Right. Yes, I would think they might have. Okay.
But back to this whole, the calling forth and the maintaining for, because we're just going into break right now, or at least we've got just a few seconds. Here we go. So we'll be back. I will close on this, the standing armies, or I should say this 2 year cycle of the federalizing of the militia and why they did it that way. And so folks, we'll be right back, and then we'll move into answering some of Paul's questions as to, you know, what they could do and what they should have been doing. But anyway, because it actually is in the Constitution. Had they followed the Constitution, we wouldn't have never created these standing armies. We'll be right back.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So what they should have been doing was they should have, and Paul, thanks for hanging in there. What they should have been doing was they should have been actually pulling up and creating a cycling or recycling of the militia and minimize the amount, because it makes it really easy if you just keep everybody and create a standing army. Mm-hmm. And so, no, the intent was not to allow that to happen. The intent was to, you know, minimize the burden of, you know, justifying a continuous force. Now, there was a justification with the expanse, so they needed to do that, but they didn't need a million men in service. Wow. And so when you really look at, and not that that was the case, I'm not even citing a number, I'm just saying that they only needed, they could have created a system, and this actually goes through the next couple of lines go through this. So they had this ability to call forth the militia. We already mentioned that a couple lines down. But they had the power to raise and support armies out of the militia.
Correct.
But no apportionment or appropriation of money for that purpose any longer than 2 years. So in other words, they were to keep it at a minimum and to provide and maintain a Navy. There's no time span for a Navy. Mm-hmm. They looked at the Navy as a permanent external force to protecting America's interests worldwide, globally, externally to the United States. The intent for the Army was only to protect the Union itself. There was never a desire, never an intent in the design of the Constitution to deploy an army worldwide.
Historically, GR, and you're a Marine, where did the Marines fit into that picture?
Well, so the Marines created the Navy.
The Marines created the Navy.
What ended up happening in the beginning of the Revolutionary War, the, you know, Continental Congress, how many ships did they have?
I'm not sure that they had very many
at all. They had zero. Every ship that they put Marines on were privately owned. And these were volunteer, you know, ships that went into service. So every time the Marines, you know, commandeered a British ship, that became a part of the Continental Navy.
Ooh, okay.
Now, so they didn't have any ships. They had captains that volunteered their ships, kind of leasing and what have you. But that's one of the reasons why they realized that, you know, they needed these things. They needed these things because the threat was primarily, the threat had to come from across the water.
Right.
And so, I mean, it wasn't like Asia, Japan, or China was threatening America by landing on the West Coast and marching all the way across the continent to get to us. Mm-hmm. That wasn't happening. So the real threat was really in Europe, you know, coming at us that way, or coming from the south, or coming from the north. I mean, it's a real roundabout way to march 1,000 miles, you know, across the Rockies and all of that just to get to us from, I mean, so we had that big barrier of protection, that right. buffer zone. And so, Yeah, the Marines actually created the Navy, because it wasn't until they actually stole the ships where those ships then became property of the Continental Congress and a part of the Continental Navy. All other ships were at that point privateers, or I should say, you know, people that were volunteering to help fight. And so from that point, so when people go, huh, the Marines created the Navy. Yeah, we were really the pirates that actually did that. And eventually, the role of the Marine Corps, you know, it didn't take long for it to actually be a ground force in Tripoli. And so from that point on, we actually developed a ground force for the Navy to be able to project. But the reason why the Army got into this is because they want, it's about staff. It's about, you know, promotions. It's about, you know, the privilege. And it's always about how many, you know, the creating a larger sea of stars for career officers.
Okay.
And we didn't need to do that. I mean, if there's a role, it should have been done externally. If it's an external role for military application, military use, then it should have fell upon the Navy, period. Mm-hmm. Because that was the design of the Navy. And so the Army, because who's the, you know, the defense secretary at that point in time was typically an Army person.
Okay.
Washington was an Army man. And how much did, you know, how much investment in Washington's administration did he spend in developing a Navy?
I'm not sure that he spent much.
He spent hardly anything. I mean, I think the only reason that there was any development on the Navy came from Congress, because clearly it was Congress's responsibility, not the president's. And so, but his chief of staff, or if you want to, his secretary of defense was a, I think Knox was one of them. I mean, he had a lot that he went through. He chewed up a lot of them. And he was pretty hard on them, but they were all Army. They were all, I should say, you know, the ground forces that fought the Revolutionary War. He didn't have any, you know, admirals or anybody from the Navy involved, from the Continental Navy. And so the Army took this dominating presence politically.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't have happened. That should never have happened. Because when you let one, so when you let the fry cook, or when you let the baker in charge of the, you know, all of the food service stuff, next thing you know, you've got lots of baked goods, and, you know, they seem to have a dominant presence in, you know, what is in the menu of what we're eating. And so that's the same thing. You've got, you know, the Army that's been dominant, and that's why they gravitated quickly towards standing armies and doing those types of things.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sure. Sure it does.
So they got this beautiful thing called the Constitution, but they just didn't, they didn't staff it properly. They didn't, you know, go through it, you know, and as far as I'm concerned,
it probably realized how good it was.
Well, it would have been a really good thing. It would have been a really good idea had the federal government actually gone through the Constitution saying, well, what does this mean? And what do we need to do? And let's go through the ratification debates, you know, for the first 10, 15 years. As they, I mean, they had the benefit of Madison and Jefferson, but I think they probably would have been able to start garnering, you know, more and have done better in basically getting us going down a path that would have been more secure. But right. Most people just, you know, kind of, we rested on the laurels of these, you know, honorable men.
Yeah. Well, you know, the other thing that I think that happens, you had the Revolutionary War and then the War of 1812. And, you know, what I think actually happens is sometimes there's just a tendency that people want to relax. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That, oh my, that's over. And then they just, whew, they just sit back and say, wow, that's passed. And so it doesn't occur to them, let's go back and see what we did wrong, what we could have done better, and how we can keep, how we can maintain what has done, so what we put together here that's done so well for us. I just think that, you know, when you have a hard trial, sometimes there's just a tendency to sit back and, ouch, that hurt, and then go on with your life.
I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, when you get home, you know, the last thing you want to do, if you're a cook, the last thing you want to do is make a meal.
Right.
Right? I mean, as a matter of fact, cooks usually eat terribly, especially if it's just a job.
Okay.
I would think that if you're a chef and you're an artist, then you're always, you know, because that's just your passion, then you're always experimenting and those types of things. You know, and as a matter of fact, I don't know how many marriages, you know, don't have an artist, you know, to feed the family. It's just a cook.
Right. my grandmother was a professional cook and she was an artist.
Ah, okay.
Okay. So, because, wow. We always had good food in our family, and so
I get it.
So
moving on. So they had this responsibility to provide and maintain the Navy, and then this next one, which is you know, and they didn't do a good job of that either. So far these past, you know, how many, three powers have been violated because they did a crappy job in providing and maintaining a Navy and, you know, putting all the strategic interest into the Navy instead of creating this Air Force and Army and so forth.
Right.
To me, and I know I really upset a lot of people in the military because they, you know, well, hey, the Air Force has it, that role should have been given to the Navy, period.
But we do have Navy pilots.
We do. Absolutely. And the Navy should have grown based on the needs of the nation instead of creating a whole new armed forces to create a whole new rank structure, a whole new personnel department. You know, if you look at the redundancy in creating the United States Air Force, it could, all of that redundancy of personnel and the management administration, that was all excessive at the expense of the American people. And so you would think that, you know, they would be a little bit more diligent in spending our tax dollars. But at that point in time, we were spend crazy, right? In the mid-50s? Anyway, so, or the 40s, I think this is the 40s when they created the Department of Air Force. But anyway, moving on. So then they have this, the next power is to make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces. When they say for the government, they're talking about governing, like the UCMJ, the regulations for the military itself. So they have the authority to govern the military, and they have the authority to basically create the regulations of them, only them. They don't have the authority anywhere to create. This isn't martial law. There's nowhere here where they have the power to suspend anything.
Okay.
And then,
and by the way, neither does the military have that power.
That is correct.
Okay.
So. The next one is to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. So this is where they, you know, get, this is their ready to be, you know, assembled army. They now have the power to call forth this trained force out in all the states to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. That has been flagrantly ignored, and they've basically violated the Constitution by creating the National Guard and the National Air Guard, because the whole point was that these forces were state-controlled state forces until they were called into service.
Correct.
Okay. So the next one is the kicker.
And before you get away from that, we can't help but point out that there is that we have an invasion on our southern border and not a single member of Congress. I've heard some people use the term invasion.
They're starting to. It's started.
Finally?
No, I'm hearing it more and more. I mean, we've been harping on this for a long time. I created that video years ago regarding the invasion. And I'm just, it's finally, people are finally saying, hey, this is not an immigration crisis. This is an invasion. It's about time that this is actually getting out there. And I'm going, wow. I mean, it's nice to see.
Yeah, it's about time they actually called it what it is.
Right.
All right. Mm-hmm. But we are not calling forth the militia or even, well, let me take that back. In some cases, you know, Texas has, you know, called out its highway patrol or its state patrol or its off and on to stop this invasion. But, you know, an invasion, the Constitution is to support the rights of all men. And if you've got an invasion at the southern border, you've got an invasion everywhere, and it is everywhere. And no one has called, you know, my senators, my congressmen have not called forth the militia to execute the laws of the union and repel this invasion.
Yeah, actually, if you
I'm
think
just of, saying,
go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm just saying that all of them are ignoring this part of the Constitution.
Well, so it's a little even worse than that, because if you look at what the federal government is doing, they're not only allowing these people, these invaders, into the country, they are redirecting them and distributing them throughout the republic.
Yeah.
So in other words, they're enabling the invasion to have a much broader impact on the nation. And I've been telling, this goes back a decade easily. When, you know, we started talking, you know, I started talking, and when I wrote my book and so forth, that when we look at this invasion, you know, you can't not have a housing crisis. When you let all of these people in, that now they need housing. They're taking our housing. They're filling up our classrooms. And it's not about humanity. Yeah. This is about the rule of law. When Christ comes and destroys all governments and opens all borders, that's one thing. But it's another thing when we actually look at the law itself and a republican form of government and not following the law.
Hang on a minute. Are you saying that the fact that we are enabling this and distributing this invasion, that sounds almost like an insurrection, GR?
Well, actually it is. So the insurrection is not against the government. The insurrection is against the Constitution. This is what I've been saying. Ooh. So this is what I said. If you really look at January 6th, the fact that Congress locked down the Capitol, that was the real insurrection against the Congress, or I should say against the Constitution.
Against the
Well, the Constitution mandates that, you know, the people will have the privilege of, you know, peacefully assembling and being able to petition government for the redress of grievances. And when they lock the doors of Congress and say, you cannot petition us, we do not have to hear you, they actually, that was an insurrection against the Constitution.
Mm. Wow.
And they're literally turning the table saying, oh, well, you're not following our laws because everything we do is constitutional. BS. Almost everything that they're doing is unconstitutional. They are in the throes of an insurrection. And what's sad is the Democrats, you know, you can't get them to actually pick up the Constitution to acknowledge, wow, they don't have the authority to do that. They couldn't have done that.
It's not on their radar. I think they know what they're doing.
I've gone out, and I can only do so much, but I can't understand why the narrative has never shifted towards the offensive against our politicians. In other words, our politicians are the ones that are committing the insurrection, And nobody has shifted the focus to say, hold on, where do you have the authority to do this? Where did you have the authority to lock us out? Where did you have the authority to basically come and grab us and basically try us for exercising our constitutional rights? The fact that you're punishing us for actually exercising our constitutional rights is even a further insurrection.
Correct.
And and Pence is an evil, treasonous son of a whatever. I mean, this is where my potty mouth can really get a hold of me. And so I look at these people, we're supposed to love our enemies, but these people are in the throes of attacking us. And I believe when we really look at our enemies that are in our house, I think Christ was pretty clear that we're supposed to, drive them out from among us. And
so
go ahead.
For some people who don't know just how deep that is, just at some point, you're going to give them background. I know you've covered this in other shows, but the Congress got petitioned on January 4th about the problems about the constitutional issue with the Electoral College.
That's true.
They got petitioned. Okay. Yep. Every single one of them who were in office knew, and especially Pence.
Pence, yep. They were all served. And, they were all served with that petition. That's correct.
They were all served. They all knew that there was, and Congress is the only venue in which that could have been addressed.
Yep.
Right?
That is correct.
And so they failed. They all failed. And Pence particularly, and all this pressure they came about, the voter fraud. Voter fraud was a state issue, but the constitutional issue of having of the states going around the Constitution to change the way the electors were chosen.
Yep.
That was a constitutional issue. So when you say, I just wanted to give some background to why you're restraining yourself about what you're saying, what you want to say about Pence, is that not only did he have the power, all of them are culpable because they all were informed.
Right. Well, I mean, there are a lot of other players, Pelosi, Schumer. I mean, all of the power brokers on the left, and even the power brokers on the right, like Liz Cheney, there were plenty that actually took the mantra, that actually picked up that whatever flag they're flying, it's probably the hammer and the sickle. They're flying a flag of communism, and they're basically in subjugating us to a government that they have no authority to do. No authority to operate. And what they're doing is they're outright violating the Constitution. And that's why going through the Constitution in this type of detail is so critical.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. All right. The next step. So they have the power to call forth the militia. Now, you mentioned that, well, how come they didn't create a better system? This is the part where they had the authority to do this, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for the governing of such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states, respectively, the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So, in other words, they're supposed to be funding the organizing, the equipping, and the disciplining.
When I'm before an audience, okay, and I read this clause, I tell them, wrap your head around this for a minute. You hear so much about gun control, all right? Gun control simply means who controls the guns. All right. And so what this clause tells you is that Congress has, here's one thing, Congress has the money, the authority to expend money from the public treasury. And what is that? To put guns in your hands and teach you how to use them. Okay. That people read past this and it doesn't occur to them that Congress isn't supposed to be taking your guns away from you. They're supposed to be arming the people, because the brilliance of the founders was that we would be able to protect ourselves.
Right. And they're actually coming up with how many rounds you're supposed to have, regulating how many rounds. The one thing that they can actually regulate is the minimum amount of rounds you need to have.
Right.
Right. They could say you have to have at least this many, but anything over that, that's on you. In other words, if you, and as a matter of fact, they should be giving you rounds on an annual basis for your basic familiarization fire, for getting out and firing on the range and, you know, maintaining your skills.
Sure.
That's called the disciplining, the organizing and disciplining, because the disciplining isn't just going out and marching and, you know, controlling. It is improving your skills, disciplining yourself to be better a marksman and so forth.
And by golly, they've got the authority to do that.
Yep.
By the way. So let me ask you one other question real quick about this last part and the authority of training militia according to discipline prescribed by Congress. Yes. I heard recently, I hadn't known this before, and maybe you would know if it's true, that the purpose of West Point was to train officers to distribute out to the states to be leaders of the militia. Had you heard anything like that?
Well, so West Point, and, you know, they had, you know, these academies, but they were basically schools. In other words, the states had their own academies. Some states had, you know, a military type of academy because it was a model that Britain had. And some states didn't. Some states were more pacifist. I mean, the Puritans, I don't think... I don't want to say they didn't have an academy. I'm not sure if every state had a military academy that they would send their young men to educate them. Mm-hmm. And these were the young men that became officers because they were educated. The enlisted were the uneducated.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, most enlisted, you know, they couldn't even sign their name. They just did an X, and the officer witnessed that, you know, that was this person. So anyway, but when I look at what they should have been doing, because we're literally out of time. I mean, the show's over here. So when I look at what they should have been doing, they deliberately did these things to marginalize, because there was this opportunity for those generals in the Department of Defense, the Department of War, to create careers for themselves and their fellow friends and maintain a stability so that they wouldn't have to get a job. It's the same thing with the Department of Interior and maintaining these federal jobs, the federal employment and so forth. I mean, we talked about this. It just becomes easy to start working and getting a pension from the government when they had no authority to do those things. And this is the problem we have. So when we come back tomorrow, folks, we'll get back into let's just say we're going to do kind of a refresher on this whole militia thing. We'll kind of do a summary of how all of these different parts, because a big part of these powers are for the militia and our security, national defense. So we'll kind of do a summary on that, and then we'll get into the exclusive legislation, properties, and those things. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contributions donations page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.